in the center of the designated cities to draw the undead in so that they will maximize the effectiveness of the explosion. The warning also made sure to mention that this would cause much more activity within the dead ranks. The jets flew overhead today at around noon and dropped their payload. I know it must be loud if I can hear it from this far. It is a sort of high-pitched, oscillating whine. Annabelle doesn't like it, but she is getting used to it, despite her hackles being perpetually raised. It's hard to believe January will be over in a few minutes. John and I had to use our mailbox sound device today while loading up the H2. This was a couple of hours after the military dropped the sound decoy. The things were coming out of the woodwork, and many of them were milling around our street. We made four trips until the things destroyed John's noisy invention. One of them finally yanked it out of the mailbox and used it as a bludgeon, denting the mailbox top. We loaded everything up, and it's almost time to leave. It's dark outside, and I have turned the lights off so that when we leave, our natural night vision will be already adjusted. John and I will be flying east in our small aircraft. I have studied the manuals over and over. Not much else to do besides count down hours. I think we may be a little overweight on the bird. Oh well. I will get her in the air. 10 hours until the end of the world. Nuclear winter. February 1st, 0430 hours. The three of us, including Annabelle, slipped out the back last night and made for the Hummer. Our eyes were adjusted. Apparently, Annabelle's were also, as she warned us of a ghoul lurking in the shadows. John told me he felt the hair stand up on her back. He was carrying her, and we could both hear the quiet barks through the muzzle. I dispatched the creature with an aluminum bat and continued on to our vehicle. There were a few lurking around behind the vehicle, but they were a safe distance away, and we were able to make it inside. Even through the window, we could hear the oscillating whine of sound decoys. The unearthly moans of the dead in the distance seemed to rise over even the decoys. The drive to the racetrack was pretty much uneventful. I drove slowly and kept my headlights off. Other than the occasional thump of one of those things off my fender, there was nothing. The moonlight showed me the way. We pulled up to the chain-link gate that led to the track. I turned on my headlights and the C-clamp was still there just as I left it. My rifle and me exited the Hummer and we went over to the gate and unlatched the clamp. Although I didn't see any of them around, I could smell them and sense their presence in the distance. After pulling the Hummer in, I reattached the C-clamp. 100 yards off, I could faintly see the outline of one of the undead. No matter. It would take at least 100 of them to breach the fence. John and I unloaded the Hummer and packed up the Cessna. I performed the pre-flight checklist and got her ready to take to the air. I got in the cockpit and performed the engine start checklist. She started with no difficulty. Checked the fuel pressure and quantity, and it was all in the green. John and I both latched our exterior doors and turned on my landing takeoff lights. It was then that I'd remembered my gruesome discovery a few days before, the poor mechanic that had been crushed under a lift and dined upon. I also remembered my encounter with one of them, and how I killed it and put a 55-gallon oil drum in front of the door to keep whatever else was in there from getting out. My landing lights were pointing at the garage door. The door was wide open. The barrel was tipped over on its side. It was at that time the garage's mystery resident showed itself. A loud thump on the pilot's side window, and the thing was there, drooling and pressing its lips to the cockpit glass like one of those algae suckers in a fish tank. It scared the shit out of me. I can't believe I forgot about the garage until I was in the plane. That could have been my demise. I started to taxi my takeoff area. The thing was shuffling after the plane. I tried to avoid hitting it with my propeller, as I didn't want to risk any damage. I pushed the throttle to full power and fed a rich mixture of fuel to the engine. We started to lurch forward. My anti-collision strobes were making the stadium look like it was in a thunderstorm. I looked in my rearview mirror and could see two ghouls inside the perimeter shuffling toward me. 50 knots. 60 knots. 75 knots. I pulled the controls back and started to climb. It was going to be close. The engine strained as I put her at max blast. I could almost swear that I felt my main landing gear touch one of the bleachers as I cleared the top row of seats. We were airborne and flying SSE in the direction of Corpus. Earlier, before we left the Hummer, John and I checked the TV radio and checked it twice to make sure that there wasn't a nuke on its way there with our names on it. The same cities were scrolling across the bottom of the screen. I guess Corpus just wasn't big enough. Damn. I know they have enough nukes, but somehow I bet they were running low on pilots to drop them. En route, we could make out the faint signs of headlights on the interstate. I wondered if it were other survivors evacuating. I could do no good, and probably get both John and I killed if we attempted to land on or near the interstate. I was flying at 7,000 feet in accordance with visual flight rules, VFR, out of habit. Somehow, I don't think an airborne collision is likely since I'm probably the only manned prop plane in the air in all of North America. I'm certain that there were probably several Predator drones patrolling the skies, giving status reports on the multiplying dead below. Halfway to Corpus, I saw something I didn't expect. Lights. Actual electric lights. Yes, fires were commonplace since we took off, but not electricity. According to my charts, we were approaching Beeville, Texas. There was a small municipal airstrip there. I checked my fuel and knew it would be close, so John and I decided to buzz the airport, since it had lights, and see if we could land safely. I was flying southeast above I-37 when I broke off for Beeville Municipal Airport. Miraculously, the GPS satellites were still working, and I keyed the coordinates into the GPS. 28-21.42 north, 097-47.27 west. The green LCD was pointing in the same direction that I was headed, so I knew I was on course. We arrived at the airstrip about 8 minutes later, just like the GPS indicated, and I lowered my altitude to 800 feet to check the runways. The runways ran northwest to southeast. I decided to fly by runway 12, since the wind would favor my landing there. The directional beacons were still on, so I knew I could make the landing as long as there wasn't something parked on the tarmac. After one flyby, I brought her around for a landing. On my first pass, I saw a fuel truck sitting next to the taxiway. I landed the plane and taxied over to the fuel truck. I left the plane running and walked around the back toward the truck. My rifle was at the ready in case anything was to go wrong. I turned my LED light on, and its bright beam illuminated the area around the truck. I forgot to turn off the anti-collision strobes when I got out of the plane, so they were flashing brightly, giving me snapshots of the area every 2 seconds. I walked over to the hose, pulled it off the rung, and checked the pressure on the fuel pump. Looks like it was never shut off. No matter. It wouldn't drain the battery unless it was constantly pumping. There was enough fuel in this truck to fly cross-country 2 or 3 times. Too bad I couldn't take it all. I walked over and unlatched the fuel cap on the wing with a wood block that was inside the door. I didn't want to take any chances with spark. I normally wouldn't leave the engine running to refuel, but hey, I wasn't taking any chances of this bird not wanting to start. I filled the tanks up until some of it started splashing out on the wing. I returned the hose to its cradle on the fuel truck and started to walk back. I couldn't hear anything over the engines. As I walked back to the plane, John was frantically trying to signal me. He jumped out and started running toward me. I turned around and instinctively raised my weapon. Good timing. I squeezed off around and decapitated the creature from pretty much point blank. Glad I had John with me, because this 7-foot pus sack was the right height to bend down and just take a chunk out of my neck before I knew what hit me. The thing was just a convulsing maggot pie on the ground now. John shot me a worried glance and got back in the bird with Annabelle. She didn't like flying, and puked twice since we took off. Got back into the air and continued for Corpus. Checking the chart, Corpus was 144 miles from San Antonio. We needed 150 miles safe distance. It was 0315 when we were back airborne. That meant 6 hours and 45 minutes until they dropped their payload. An hour after taking off from Beeville, we were over Corpus airspace. Our destination would be the Naval Air Station east of the city. It would give us our minimum safe distance. Naval Air Station Corpus Christi is a training base. The aircraft there would be of no tactical importance, just single-engine reliable training turboprops. The lights were still on at the naval base. they must be using an on-site generator. Most bases have alternate sources of power in the event of enemy attack on the power grid. As I flew over the base, destruction was apparent. The base perimeter was destroyed, and there were hundreds of them on the base. Same routine. Checked the airfield. The tower beacon was still operational and flashing its white-blue signal. The lights inside the tower were on, and I could see no movement inside the airfield perimeter as I made my pass. There was a separate fence for the airfield and admin tower buildings. I could see 50 or 60 single-engine prop aircraft on the taxiways parked. T-34C turbomenters and T-6 Texans made up the bulk of them. That was more like it. I was familiar with the T-34C, and I knew they all had parachutes, unlike the Cessna. John and I decided to land near the tower and use it as shelter for the night. We landed the plane and quickly shut the engine down near the tower as to avoid attracting too many of them. The door to the tower was unlocked, but it was shut. Just as I suspected, the tower was abandoned. No sign of life or death inside. John and I took our food, water, and weapon and ammo inside for the night, locking the door behind us. It was a heavy steel door, and I knew it would hold. Ground Zero. 10:50 hours. John and I finally got to sleep around 0540 this morning. The tower was clean and quiet and safe, and that felt good. I set the alarm on my watch for 0930 to give me 30 minutes of prep time for the show. We turned on the radio. The same message was being looped from the other day. Around 10:05, I knew it happened. The blast wave must have been traveling at immense speed. The wind picked up, and I could see the trees blowing toward the east, not swaying. My eyes were trained northwest toward the direction of San Antonio. I saw it. It was small from this distance, but it was there. We witnessed a bright orange mushroom cloud on the horizon. Damn, they must have really dropped the big one for me to see and feel the wind from over 150 miles. It was a clear, calm day. I knew the wind would not be radioactive from this distance, but the force that pushed the wind was. I just hoped that the gas cloud didn't drift this way. I noticed something else that was odd. Houston was northeast of me. John was checking that direction. There was no blast. Granted, it was 217 miles away. Just odd. I wondered if they were running late. The tower has electricity, water pressure, and radios. I think I'm going to stay here and ponder what just happened. February 2nd, 14:35 hours. I woke up this morning and grabbed the binoculars to survey the area. The first thing I checked was the windsock. It was blowing west. That was good news. I wouldn't be glowing in the dark today. The airfield was secure. All naval air stations have 8-foot-high chain-link fences to keep unauthorized personnel off the flight line. There were numerous dead around the perimeter in the distance. They were paying no attention to the fence. They were just there. Annabelle was whining. John was monitoring the radios, so I decided to take her out. It was the I have to pee whine. Walked her down the stairs and took her out to a patch of grass on the side of the tower opposite the runways. She did her business and sniffed the air. She's a small dog, but she has a good sniffer. The hair on the back of her neck was standing up again. I took her back upstairs and shut the door to the tower behind me. The tower had a 360-degree view, so I walked around the center over to the grassy side to see maybe if I could catch a glimpse of what was pissing her off. There was nothing. It was probably the wind carrying a bad smell to her. She was happy again, and I poured her some water and gave her some dog food. John was wearing headphones, listening. In the control towers, everyone used headsets because it would be chaos if every radio played out loud. John was clearly listening to something besides static. I walked over to his panel, checked his frequency, and went to another terminal to listen. There were two pilots talking to each other. One of them asked the other if they had both made the best decision. They must have been near our tower, or we wouldn't pick them up. They probably thought they had all the privacy in the world right now. As far as they knew, no one was alive to listen to them in this area. I wondered what they meant. Were these the same pilots that dropped the nukes? My question was soon answered. As their conversation went on, I discovered that these pilots refused to drop their ordnance. They didn't see it as a good decision, so instead of following their orders, apparently they chose exile. I really can't blame them. They were human, just like me. I'm not sure I could have dropped it either. I wonder which cities were spared. My guess was that one of them was Houston, or maybe even Austin, although the San Antonio blast might have taken care of them. John and I couldn't carry all of our food and water on the plane with us. Water wasn't a problem right now, but I would say in a couple weeks, food would be. Last night the fire to the northwest was bright. Everything that could burn was probably burning. I bet my house was nothing but dust now. 21:43 hours. After rummaging through the tower, John and I came across a large aluminum case with a master lock attached. We were able to pry it open with a set of bolt cutters from the maintenance closet one flight down. The case was a foam padded equipment case used to store night vision goggles. There were four sets inside, monocular type, using civilian AA batteries. I should have known. Tower controllers use them at night to warn pilots of obstructions on the runway. Most military airfield towers have them. Now, John and I had them. They were shit for depth perception, but hey, I felt better with them. I tried them out. John and I turned off all interior lights. I adjusted the focus and starlight power. The airfield was bathed in a green glow. These were going to be really useful. I could even see field mice scurrying on the runway near the planes. Tomorrow, I'm going to go out and check the planes for myself. February 3rd, 15:23 hours. I went out this morning to check on a few of the aircraft and pick out the best one in case John and I had to leave. These turboprops were much more reliable than the Cessna, and I at least had some hours in them. I knew they were all in working order, but I carefully screened the one I thought looked the most maintained. It was aircraft number 07. John and I are going into the hangars today to find some equipment. While I was out this morning, I carefully walked the perimeter fence, staying clear of areas where they were lurking on the opposite side. It was a big airfield. On the ground, using my binoculars, I could see movement inside one of the administration buildings on the third floor. Alive? Not sure. I quietly moved back to the tower and alerted John of my find. I was starting to think that the only way to defeat these monsters was to just wait them out. It was like a long prison sentence. I hadn't thought about my parents for a long time. My hopes weren't too high as to their fate. I thought about taking one of the birds and landing it in a field near my home, just so I could get some closure. I could never ask John to come along. It was just a passing thought. February 4th, 14:47 hours. We fueled one of the T-34s up, checked the engine, showed John how to work the APU, auxiliary power unit. The T-34C can perform a battery start. It's just best to start it from the external gas-powered auxiliary unit. After this, John and I locked Annabelle in the tower and got ready to check out the hangar for any equipment that we may need. John and I were getting adept at this. He would open the door and I would clear the room. It was a ghost town inside the hangar. John and I edged our way to a room marked Flight Equipment Maintenance. The door was halfway open and the lights were on inside. I rushed into the room, weapon ready. I almost shot a dummy that was standing there modeling its flight gear. Too small for me, but looked like it would fit John. After clearing the room and shutting the door, just in case, I told John to strip the dummy and try on the flight suit and helmet. I grabbed a helmet off the maintenance completed rack and walked over to the test radio to test the boom microphone. It worked fine. We grabbed a couple survival vests equipped with the bare essentials, as well as one of the wooden model T-34s that might prove useful if I had to explain how something worked to John. There were also sets of keys marked fuel truck key hanging on a rack. After getting back to the tower, I started showing John the basics of flight. I used some flight manuals and the wooden model to give him some idea on avionics and how aircraft control surfaces work. I asked John if he would like to go up and check things out, sort of a recon mission. He agreed, and we suited up. 19:32 hours. John and I took off around 15:45. We flew northwest at over 200 knots to survey the blast damage. It only took us 40 minutes to get to the outskirts, and that was close enough. The city was rubble. We were at high altitude, over 10,000 feet, to avoid any residual radiation. Decided it was best to head back. As soon as we were out of danger, we dropped down to an altitude of 2,000 feet. It was a clear day, and the sun was at our back. We followed the interstate. John asked me to roll us over so he could get a good look at the ground. I rolled over about 30 degrees. John and I gazed down to the interstate. These things were making a mass exodus out of the city. I wondered how effective the nukes were on those not in the immediate vicinity. I doubt radiation has any effect on the creatures. Only the heat from the blasts could have destroyed them. Minimum safe distance for a living human being would be 150 miles, but not for them. I bet they could survive within 20 miles. John snapped a digital of the ghouls' retreat from the city. We touched down just as the sun was starting to set and taxied back to our parking spot near the tower. It truly was a dead place. We saw no sign of life. Only thousands and thousands of them walking the landscape. The lights of Corpus Christi would eventually lead them to the city. February 5th, 22:01 hours. They are increasing in number at the west side of the fence. That side is approximately a quarter of a mile from the tower. Using night vision goggles, I can see them shambling in the distance. The green, grainy image is very surreal and disturbing. John and I turned the lights off when we noticed them earlier today. I have a feeling they are the first wave, pushed out of the major cities. Damn, a Geiger counter would have been a good Christmas gift last year. No more frivolous trips in the aircraft. Don't want them getting worked up. I'm going on a scouting mission tonight to the admin building, where I saw movement the other day. I have the advantage of night vision, so I think I will be fine. Plus, I need batteries. February 6th, 04:30 hours. I went alone last night to the admin building. John stayed back in the tower. As soon as I left the top floor of the tower, I shut the door and switched to NVGs. The familiar green, grainy image faded in. It made me feel invisible. The building was a good 300 yards from the tower. I took my rifle for a main weapon, and the Glock for backup. Only took 58 rounds of .223 for the carbine, 29 rounds in each magazine. I wasn't heading out to fight a war, just to scavenge. I also took some heavy-duty black zip ties and some rope that I found in the tower. For some reason, I don't think the me of a month ago would have left the tower tonight. In the back of my mind, I keep thinking, what is left to live for? Carefully approaching the front door to the administration building, I begin to methodically check the windows for movement. Because of the NVG's limitations, I couldn't see inside the windows until I was close enough to almost hit the building with a thrown rock. I couldn't tell what was moving up on the third floor. I thought for a second that it could be the shadow of an oscillating fan, backlit by a hall light of some sort. That is what I wanted it to be. I was at the front door. It was unlocked. Carefully stepping in, I listened for any possible sound. Reminded me of all the hearing tests I had to take in the military. It was quiet, like a soundproof room inside. After stepping through the second set of doors, I walked into the center of the room and noticed a large staircase that I assume led up to the second and third floors. I took another step and heard a loud crunch beneath my feet. I stepped on a piece of broken glass, an especially loud piece. It was then that I started hearing it. Sounded like a group of four or five on the floors above me. Low, moaning, and slow-moving feet could be heard moving over the debris above. I knew what it was. They had heard me, and they wanted to come downstairs and dine on my flesh. I quickly spun around and headed back toward the door. Behind me, I heard the sound of one or more of them falling down the stairs. Sounded like a garbage bag full of wet leaves. I sprinted as fast as I could for the door. After making it through the first set of double doors, I quickly pulled out a couple large black zip ties and secured the door. I ran through the next door, outside door, and did the same. They were hard plastic, and I knew they would only slow them down. I put four of them on this door. Just as I was stepping away, they broke through the interior door and started banging on the door I had just secured. I started running back to the tower. I heard the loud, frustrated thuds as I made my escape. Then, the loud crash of a shattered glass. I looked over my shoulder and saw one of them falling out of a third-floor window. All the noise must have excited it. I made it to the tower and ran up the stairs to the top door where John and I were staying. I knocked and yelled through to John to dim the lights and put on his NVGs. After seeing that the crack below the door went dark, I stepped inside to see if the fallen ghoul had chased me. No sign of it. The door was locked below. I would hear it if it tried to gain entrance. We are safe for now. 15:34 hours. John was listening to the radios. He has become depressed over the death of his wife the past few days, and scanning channels when he called me over to check something out. He told me that there was something crawling under one of the planes, but he couldn't see it anymore. I grabbed the binoculars and scanned the area that John was pointing at. It was the corpse that had fallen out of the window last night. It was pulling itself with its arms. Its legs were being dragged motionlessly behind it. I didn't like the idea of going out there and killing it, and it wasn't bothering anything right now. February 7th, 18:26 hours. Movement. John and I noticed it a few hours ago. From my angle, I couldn't tell if the admin building door had stayed secure with the zip ties. More of them were gathering on the west end of the fence. Went out to check the plane and make sure it was ready for flight, if we needed it to be. I couldn't park the plane too close to the tower after our scouting trip to the city, because of the soft, wet grass from a recent rain. I had to park the plane a good 200 yards from the tower, so it was a good trek to go out and check on it. I snuck to the plane without incident. I didn't see the crawling ghoul anywhere around. This fenced area was huge, and it could be anywhere. The fuel truck was about 50 yards further than the plane. I started walking toward it, and then I saw them. The angle I was standing before blocked my view of them. I counted 10 inside the perimeter of the fence, walking around the blind side of the admin building. They didn't see me, but they would see the truck if I tried to pull it to the aircraft to refuel it. My stomach ached at the thought of refueling the aircraft in the dark, but it had to be done. 2100 hours. I grabbed the NVGs and spare fuel truck keys that John and I found a couple of days earlier, and went out in the dark to refuel the plane. Weapon ready, I slowly glided across the airfield to the fuel truck, this time taking a different angle so that I could see the admin building. No sign of them. Made it to the fuel truck and climbed up to the window and looked inside. JIC. It was clear. Opened up the door, put it in neutral. I had never tried to push a truck this big, and now I know why. You can't. I was going to have to start the engine. I assumed the creatures couldn't see in the dark, but I knew they would hear me. Reluctantly, I took the key from my pocket and put it in the ignition. I hesitated, and then, cringing, I pushed in the clutch, held the brake, and turned the key. After turning it over twice, the engine came to life and I popped the clutch and shot over to the aircraft. On the way, I hit the pump controls inside the vehicle so they would be ready when I jumped out. Parked the truck, jumped out, and started walking toward the plane. I could make out something moving in the grass 100 yards away. I adjusted the sensitivity on my goggles and saw it. It was the gimpy ghoul in the grass pulling itself toward the tower. I would have to take care of it on my way back. Then came the blinding flash of John's flashlight through my NVGs from the tower. It was Morse code, to be sure. B-E-H-I-N-D. I swung around to see six of them working their way around the fuel truck. I had no choice. I readied my carbine and ran to the aircraft. I jumped up on the wing and started shooting at them. I took out two of them and missed another. I was careful not to shoot at the two that were in direct line of sight between the fuel truck and myself. I had two more to take down before I had to carefully handle the other two. Shot another in the head. Its forehead opened up like a spring flower. The flash from my muzzle was really playing hell in my night vision. I had to adjust the intensifier. It was much darker through the lens as I took down the fourth ghoul with a head and neck shot. There were two more. The two, that were risky to shoot, closed in. They were at the plane, trying to climb up on the wing. I shot one in the shoulder, throwing it off. The other almost grabbed my boot before I dispatched it with another headshot. The last wounded ghoul got back on its feet and raised its arms like a deranged Frankenstein as it came at me. I jumped off the wing opposite the monster and watched it as it started walking around the aircraft toward me. It was dark, and the thing just kept running into the wing and empennage of the aircraft. I carefully aimed, as to avoid damage to the bird, and let one shot ring out. The jaw tore away from the face, letting the orphaned tongue hang freely. Even in the limited color perception I had with the goggles, it was a disgusting sight. It slumped back and kept coming at me, and let out a gurgling sound in its throat. I shot the bastard again, ending its miserable existence. After dragging all the bodies by the legs out of the way of the aircraft, I began to refuel it. It took almost 10 minutes to top it off. During this time, I could now hear the moans of the undead carried on the wind. The gunfire excited them. It was a terrible sound. After the aircraft refueled, I made for the tower, no detours. Once again, the gimp ghoul was nowhere to be seen. WTF. I'm safe inside for the night right now. The moans continue. Another night with earplugs. The thought of the night, I killed 6 of them. That leaves Gimpy and another 4 inside the fence. Where are they? February 8th, 1822 hours. Awoke this morning to a banging sound on the steel door downstairs. It sounded like more than one of them. John and I crept downstairs to check things out. From the sounds, there were multiple fists banging on the door. Low moans could be heard through the steel. I checked the lock to make sure it was solid. This was the only door in or out of the tower. The only other way down was a 200-foot drop from the balcony. John and I brought down a heavy desk to place in front of the door. I went up top and out on the observation deck. I couldn't see down because of the roof over the door area. Using my binoculars, I checked the west fence in the distance. There were more, but the fence was holding. I guessed that the creatures banging on the door were the leftovers from my battle earlier. I don't want to risk opening the door below. I don't know the best way to dispose of them. February 9th, 21:42 hours. The banging stopped last night, and the undead at the bottom of the stairs must have just given up, probably because they never saw us or heard us in here. John and I were still and quiet the whole day yesterday. There was no need to go outside today, as the plane was refueled and we still had power running water in the tower. I even got a chance at a shower in the bathroom one floor down. There was a deep sink and a garden hose. The floor panel was plastic and had a drain in the center, and the whole room was just a janitor closet, so I rigged the hose up above my head and took a nice shower. Had to use a bar of soap for shampoo, but no well. Beggars can't be choosers, or so they say. I hadn't shaved in a few days. The razor felt good on my face. I felt like a new man after I had washed up. I did some laundry, in the sink with the bar soap, and hung it in the stairwell to dry. I told John about my little hose trick, but he wasn't interested. He just keeps getting worse and worse, grieving over his wife. I do not know what my long-range plans will be. The world is a different place now. The range on the turboprop aircraft is just over 400 miles. That gives us some options. For a little while today, I actually thought about finding what was left of the military. The questions that they would ask me would be difficult to answer. How did you survive on the base, son? I almost feel guilty about not dying with my comrades. It reminds me of a Twilight Zone episode I saw before the shit hit the fan. It was an episode about a Navy submarine that sank with one survivor. The sailor felt guilty and kept seeing his dead, bloated shipmates calling him to the deep. Please, don't let me dream tonight. February 10th, 2350 hours. The west fence could fail. There are hundreds around the perimeter. The lights of the city have drawn them. I would hate to be shopping in downtown Corpus Christi right now. I have spent most of the day with the binoculars, studying their movements. I saw birds swooping down at some of them. One of the creatures had no arms, and two buzzards were taking advantage of this by perching themselves on the corpse's shoulders and pecking the flesh from its skull. The corpse just gnashed its teeth, snapping at them to no avail. Serves the bastard right. John and I have tried to figure out what our next step will be, but the safety of the tower has lulled us into a semi-false sense of security. With the limited range on the aircraft, and some areas being radioactive, I'm guessing, it's tough to make a decision. I don't know how to fly a helicopter, so if we found an island, I would need a decent strip of semi-level land to take her down. It has been somewhere in the ballpark of a month since the dead walked. I see signs of decomposition in some of them, but some of them look as though they might have bought the farm recently. I'm curious as to the effects of ambient radiation on the undead. I know for certain that they would be harmful to the touch, but what effect on the corpse itself? Would the radiation kill the bacteria that caused the corpse to naturally rot? I shudder to think that the bombs dropped could have done more damage than intended good. We are running out of food. We have perhaps a week left. I'm sure there is food in some of the surrounding buildings, but I am not prepared at this time to risk my life to get it, as I am certain there are more of those creatures trapped in the confines. I have been fighting off the shock of this for some time now, and I don't know how much longer it will be before I break down. I suppose it is the natural course of things, and I just don't wish to be a basket case at the wrong time. John isn't any better. I played with Annabelle today, as she needed it. She is a good little pup. She can sense that both John and I are on edge, but she doesn't know how to make it better. John and I have decided that one of us needs to be up checking out the perimeter at all times. Going to get some rest, and this is not to be confused for sleep. My shift is in 4 hours. February 11th, 1713 hours. Using a variation of the square knot, I tied 3 lengths of 100-foot nylon line together to form a sort of escape line, if it were needed. Tying knots into the line every 3 feet, including the mating knots, caused the 300-foot length to shorten some, but still allowed it to touch the ground when tied to the balcony and thrown over. I am almost certain these things cannot climb, but still, I pulled the escape rope up and left it neatly coiled outside the balcony door, tied to a sturdy exterior pipe. The fence is still holding them out, but that is only because they have no evidence that food exists inside. I suppose if they were to see us, or figure out that we were here, they could knock the fence down with ease, making a bad day for John and I. I think we are too far from the west fence for them to see. Clean the weapons today. I also showed John how to operate the Car 15. I also noticed a roof access on the tower. It was probably so that maintenance personnel could get up there and repair the numerous antennas and beacons. I checked it out and climbed up there. It was at least 10 feet above the balcony. I know it has been at least a month since any maintenance has been performed on any of the aircraft, so I went out today and crept over to the aircraft and pulled out both the pilot and passenger parachute to make sure they were in good working order. If something happened to the engine, at least John and I would have a choice. I never spotted the loose ghouls that were inside the fence. At least 4, plus the incapacitated gimp creature. Of course, I wasn't looking for them either. I took the parachutes back to the tower. After giving them a good visual inspection, I felt better about taking the plane, number 07, up again, when the need should arise. I keep looking west, making sure our life barrier holds. February 12th. 1913 hours. There are dead birds on my side of the west fence. I could see them today with my binoculars. I counted 6 in all. They did not appear eaten. They just look as if they died there. They are on the ground, about 4 feet from the fence, with the mass of the ghouls. I can't tell what kind of bird. They are black, so that rules out most birds of prey. Not a big deal, I suppose, but I keep thinking about the black buzzards that were perched on the shoulders of the armless creature, pecking its flesh. Today was uneventful. The fence was still holding. I am going out tonight to load the extra ammunition supplies in the avionics bay of the aircraft. I will be especially quiet and leery of the unaccounted-for dead that are lurking inside the perimeter. Only one thing drives these creatures, and that is living flesh. I have not seen them attempt to eat each other. Something must be drawing the inner perimeter creatures out of my view. Annabelle is sleeping. I wish I had the carefree thoughts of a dog right now. Ignorance is bliss. 21:22 hours. I'm shaking right now. I haven't been afraid of the dark since I was a child. However, my fears were renewed tonight. I loaded the items into the bay of the aircraft. It was cloudy out and barely a moon, so it was pretty dark. It was then that my goggles went black. I had some batteries with me if this happened, but I didn't anticipate the goggles would die that quickly. I fumbled with them in the dark. I was well over 100 yards from the tower. As I sat there in the dark trying to find where to insert the batteries, I kept hearing shuffling sounds. My mind was playing tricks on me. The fear was mounting. I finally got the batteries inserted correctly and slammed the NVGs over my head and adjusted the intensifier. As soon as the grady green image came in, I checked my perimeter. Nothing. This shit is getting to me. I ran back to the tower, up the stairs, and sat there. John was looking at one of the charts we had found a few days before. Looking over his shoulder, I saw a place that he had circled. Mustang Beach was not very far from us at all. February 13th, 2013 hours. It's dark outside and very cold, especially up here in the tower. I suppose if we were to turn on the lights it would warm things up, but it would also excite the creatures on the other side of the west fence. I'm sure they would see it. I went up to the roof access at sundown and marveled at the stars. There weren't any lights on inside of the perimeter. John and I had taken care of this when the dead started massing on the west fence, and this made for a fine view of the Milky Way. I think John is pulling out of his emotional low and starting to recover. He actually joked around with me today. I didn't leave the confines of the tower today, but I do need to get those parachutes back to the aircraft so we have less to carry when we leave. I'm still sort of freaked out about last night, so I guess it can wait until later. It is still puzzling to me why the creatures are on the west end of the fence and not the other. I would love to have some real food. When monitoring the radios today, John heard a broadcast from an Air Force aircraft scouting the area. One key thing that John noted that disturbed me. The pilot had to turn back to base because he wanted to conserve his fuel. The pilot remarked about the limited supply back on the base. This tells me they are rationing jet fuel, therefore, they are confined to an area where it is not readily available. The government, or this part of it, is trapped just like we are. An island off the coast of Texas is starting to sound better and better. The only problem is that supplies would be difficult to come by with just the two of us scavenging. February 14th, 1440 hours. The fence is buckling inward, and I don't know how much longer it will hold. It's today or nothing. Looking at the windsock, there is a strong wind blowing east to west toward the airstrip. We will take to the air as soon as... Tower. February 15th, 2243 hours. Situation is dire. My bleeding has stopped, but I'm still lightheaded from all the blood loss. It must have been right before I was writing my last entry yesterday, when they broke through. I did not notice they were inside the perimeter until 1445, but by then it was too late. John and I saw them. The fence was down in about 100-meter section, and they were pouring into the airfield like runner ants. We gathered the necessities, what we thought were needed anyway, and started out the door to get in the bird and leave. As we reached the bottom and opened the door, there were four of them there waiting on John and I. We slammed the door shut and pushed the desk in place in front of the entry that we had brought down days before. We were fucking trapped like rats, and those bastards could sense it. It wasn't long before the moans of hundreds could be heard below, and the constant banging on the only exit door started. This tower was over 200 feet high, and only one way out. I went outside on the balcony, and my suspicions were confirmed. There were literally 300 of them congregated around the exterior door, as well as the covered area of the tower. John muzzled Annabelle, because she was starting to go nuts. I grabbed the rope and looked below to see where it would hit when I threw it. No joy. Sadly, I pulled the rope back up on the balcony, as there was no way we were making it down that rope without 100 of them seeing us and taking us out before we even touched the ground. It was then that the situation worsened. The sound of bending, aching steel could be heard below. There were so many of them. The masses were pushing their way through. At that moment, I knew we were fucked. I looked at John and told him, "I'm not ready to die yet." He said, "Me neither." And we both rushed over to the door that led down the stairs and started throwing TVs, desks, and chairs down the stairs. That would buy us a little time. We then shut the door. It opened outward, thank God. The upstairs door was not as sturdy as the bottom exterior door. Just as we got the door shut and the last remaining desk in front of it, we could hear the metal clanging of dress shoes on the stairs. John shoved Annabelle in his backpack and zipped her up to her neck. I motioned for John to get to the top of the ladder and wait for me to start passing up supplies. John waited with Annabelle in his pack at the top rung. She could sense our fear and was whimpering. First, I passed him the two most important items of my plan, the two parachutes that I never put back in the aircraft. Then, I passed up a six-pack of water bottles, then the NVGs, then a few packs of MREs. Just for some odd novelty, I passed up my case with my small laptop. Lastly, all our weapons and much of our ammunition, although shooting every last round would still leave hundreds here to deal with. They were at the upstairs door now. The door had a rectangular-shaped vertical window, about 6 by 10 inches. I could see one of them with its face pressed up to the shatterproof glass, sneering, trying to see what was inside. It started pounding and moaning when it saw me. The others soon followed suit. John climbed up onto the roof, and I followed. It was windy like the day before. This was good news, maybe. John took his pack and his dog off his shoulders and turned it around so it was being worn in the front of his body. I helped him put the parachute on and, using zip ties, I strapped as much to him as I could without hindering too much movement. I quickly showed him the basics on how to get out of the parachute when he hit the ground. I explained to him that it was very important that he unfasten the two inner thigh straps prior to the chest strap. He nodded that he got it, so I bent down and grabbed my chute. The broken glass sound erupted from below, and I was sure they pushed the shatterproof glass through the doorframe. I hoped that these things could not climb ladders. Using the carabiners for my day pack, I secured the rifle to my chest D-ring through the carrying handle. My knife was strapped to my belt for easy access when I hit the ground. I would be jumping first. At this moment came the familiar sound of bending steel and the screeching sound of the wood desk being launched across the floor. There was no way to secure the top hatch from the outside. It was simple. If they could climb, they would get up here. I gave one last lesson to John. "Make sure you pull your risers to slow your descent," I described what they looked like to him. I made John watch me as I crept to the edge of the roof. I could hear the sounds of them wandering below, trying to find their food. I could see the balcony door below me being pushed open. 2, 5, and now 12 creatures were wandering the balcony below. For some reason, they didn't look as rotted as I thought they should be. I was guessing that every bit of 200 walking dead were inside the tower at that moment. John leaned over and saw them. He was white with fear. Not just the thought of being eaten to death, but the thought of jumping the tower, breaking both legs, and not being able to give yourself a fighting chance. I knew what he was thinking. I was thinking the same thing. At that moment, the hatch on the roof access jumped up and slammed back down. Clang, clang. The creature's wedding ring was chiming on the hatch, making it rise a couple inches, then slam back down, as the back of its left hand hit. I could see the white hand for a split second, when the weight of the hatch pushed it back down. I almost fucking lost it. I somehow grabbed John's attention through this and showed him how to pull the release D-ring for the drogue. The drogue is a small parachute that catches the wind and pulls the rest of the chute out. The drogue on this chute is spring-powered. Pull the pin, and the drogue will shoot out, catching the wind, and deploy the rest of the chute. I checked the windsock on the far side of the field. Good to go. Looked below. There were many, but most of them seemed to be in the tower. I pulled the pin and held on to the ledge, so I wouldn't fall off before it deployed. The wind caught the main chute and literally yanked me off my feet. I could see the roof hatch swing completely open and heard it bash as it jackknifed and hit the roof. John was right behind me. The creatures on the balcony saw John and I jump and started almost screaming. I looked up as their outstretched hands reached for the dome of my chute. There were windows every few feet that looked in out of the stairwell. Damn. They were climbing over each other to get to the top. Many were in military uniforms. My estimate at 200 was too low. From the way they were piled on top of each other in the stairwell, there were more than likely 1,000 of them. I was slowly floating to the ground. It seemed like forever. Every window that I passed by on the way down was another snapshot, or Picasso, if you will, of dead faces and limbs crowded together. Then it was back to reality as I hit the ground. It wasn't a soft landing, but I didn't break anything. I immediately unlatched my chute and rolled out of it. I unsheathed my knife and waited for John to hit the ground. The creatures were closing in. As soon as John hit, he was attempting to get out of the chute. Neither of us wanted the wind dragging us into a group of those things. I had to help him along by slicing through the nylon harness. I told John to grab one end of the chute. We then ran through a group of those things toward the aircraft. John knew what my plan was. We wrapped at least 10 of those things up in the damaged chute by running around them and tangling up the cut harness with the drogue. Luckily, we drifted 50 meters in the direction of the aircraft when we jumped. We ran as fast as we could. In all the excitement, the dog slipped out of John's pack onto the ground. John was ahead of me, and I scooped her up on my way. She was so scared that she was trying to climb on top of my head. I don't fucking blame her. I felt the warmth of urine seeping through my clothing. She pissed herself. Come to think of it, it might have been me. We made it to the aircraft, and I slung open the cockpit glass and threw my shit in the back seat. John and Annabelle jumped in the back, and I told John to strap in. I immediately jumped in the bird and slid the cockpit closed and latched the lock. I remembered the startup sequence from the checklist, and, out of habit, started saying it aloud as I performed it. 1. Clock started. 2. Starter switch on. 3. Battery above 10 volts. 4. Ignition light on. 5. Fuel pressure light out. 6. Oil pressure rising. 7. N1 above 12%. 8. Condition level to feather. 9. Thumbs up to the lineman. I almost laughed at myself on this step. There was no lineman. Although I was sure the bastard was out there somewhere looking for us. I increased the condition lever to full bite and could feel the propeller catch air. I couldn't have avoided what happened next. There were 50 of them closing in on us. All I could do was to attempt to get it into takeoff position. One of them near the nose walked toward the prop. I always wondered what it would sound like. Now I knew. Like a big vegetable processor. That corpse lost its whole left shoulder in the deal. I checked my prop RPM. It dipped a little but cycled back up to 2200 RPM. I didn't want to hit any more of them. Using the pedals, I weaved the nose in and out of corpses as I rolled into position, buzzing a few of them, but nothing big like the first one. I checked my fuel pressure. Good to go. Everything was in the green. I pushed my power level to max and started my takeoff roll. 50 knots. The airspeed indicator kicked in. 65 knots. 70 knots. I clipped one of them with my left wing, breaking its hip, at least. Right before 80 knots. At 85 knots, I pulled the stick back and we were airborne. John already had his helmet fastened. I grabbed mine from my lap and pulled it over my head. I checked the internal communication system with John. He was reading me, but I could tell that he was in some sort of shock by the way he was talking and by the fact that his lips looked blue in the rearview mirror. The worst part of this was that we had no real place to go. As we took off, I looked over at the tower. The roof was now full of them, and they were walking off the top of it like lemmings. I was trying to fly the plane and look at the chart at the same time. I was wobbling back and forth, and I could hear John getting airsick on the speakers in my helmet. It was sort of funny, but I didn't want to laugh at him. I noticed a small abandoned airstrip called Matagorda Island Airfield, about 65 miles northeast of our position. I quickly marked it on my chart with a red ink pen. It looked like there were numerous islands there, and it wasn't too far from Corpus, so the power was probably still on. We cruised northeast for about 20 minutes at 180 knots when I started having propeller trouble. The engine was fine, but the prop kept losing pitch angle, thus not allowing it to grab as much air. In short, it kept feathering on me. I knew this was something to do with the corpse I chopped up earlier. I had no choice. I had to glide the plane in, because the prop pitch control was probably losing oil pressure. I feathered the prop with the condition lever and pulled the engine back to 300 foot-pounds of torque. According to my chart, the strip was in sight, but I couldn't see it. I descended to 3,000 feet to get a good slide solution. Below me, it looked like a tourist area, with numerous hotels lining the beach. Thank God it was February and not tourist season. At this point, I had to make a choice. I could either find another place to land, or say fuck it, and land in the street. Below, I could see a few of the creatures, but it was nothing like what we were running from. I was on borrowed time without a good propeller. I had to take her down. I pulled the stick back and left and pushed a little left rudder and glided into a 180-degree rendezvous with the road below. Nose down, gear down, and as soon as I was near the road, I flared my nose up and touched down with my main landing gear. I hit the brakes and tried to steer my wings between the telephone poles. I still had a lot of fuel, and I didn't want to be wearing flaming fuel because my wing decided to wrap itself around a pole. Along the way, I clipped one of those creatures with my right wing, doubling it over. It had hit its head so hard when it slammed its upper body into the wing that it died instantly, leaving a brown smudge of brain on the wing. I checked my speed, 50 knots. As I slowed to a halt, the immediate area was clear. I signaled John to get out. I left the engine running so that the sound of the aircraft would muffle our escape. John and I jumped out, grabbed our shit, and headed for a sign called Matagorda Island Marina. Now here we are. I gashed my leg open on the sharp bumper of a wrecked car 5 minutes into the journey. It was a long hump, a mile's worth of side streets, beachfronts, and backyards, but we are here. It is a decent-sized marina with a large ferry and a gift shop. Electricity is still on. Marina abandoned. Looks like the harbormaster took his own life. His bloated corpse is slumped over a desk in the front office, with what was left of his brain caked on a calendar marked January. The TV was still on, playing snow. February 16th, 1912 hours. I am very weak today. If it were not for John, I would be dead. Annabelle is next to me, sleeping. It is dark outside, and I have been blacking out on and off most of the day. My leg is infected, and I need some antibiotics. In the harbormaster's desk, we found some whiskey. This has served me most of the day as a disinfectant, as well as a painkiller. Tomorrow, John will go out alone to find some medicine for my infection. We are in no trouble, currently. I could hear the sound of the aircraft engine still running yesterday for at least 2 hours before it died. No matter. It was junk now anyway, as I'm sure there was no one left alive that knows how to fix it. February 17th, 22:20 hours. I'm feeling better today. We heard the sound of an engine in the distance that sounded like it could have been a dirt bike. John found a first aid kit on the ferry near here. It didn't have any pill antibiotics, but it did have some of the topical kind. I have been keeping the wound clean and washing it a few times a day, and applying the medicine. It seems to be working. I'm just still very red and sore around the cut. Last night, we heard the sounds of something in the darkness. Using the goggles, we tried to spot it, but it turned out it was only a raccoon looking for food. Tomorrow,